brisk this morning, 37 degrees in both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm not sure there is a greater pleasure than to lose oneself in a marvelous novel. And I have had that tremendous pleasure as of late exploring a wonderful novel called The Death and Life of August Sweeney. And it is the work of Samuel Ashworth, who is actually a professor of creative writing at George Washington University. This is Professor Ashworth's first novel, and it is a beaut. It's an extraordinarily well-crafted story that really has two different protagonists. One of them is a doctor, an autoptist, who is performing an autopsy on a famous but scandal-ridden chef by the name of August Sweeney. And we are taken back and forth between the life of this Dr. Maya Zhu in the midst of this ongoing autopsy, and at certain points taken back to past events in her life and alternating with the eventful, colorful life of this famous chef, August Sweeney. And Dr. Zhu is trying to uncover the mystery of exactly what has caused this famous chef's death. And along the way, we end up learning so much about the human body and what it means to perform an autopsy and that sort of journey of discovery, what it is and what it is not. And we are also, in a sense, taken into the heart of...
I'm Gregory Berg. And I hope that you can join me for Monday's morning show here on WGTD. One of our scheduled guests will be Tyler.
Learning the trade and struggling with mistakes and dreaming of greater accomplishments and so on. All of that and more wrapped up in this really wonderful book, which is published by the Santa Fe Writers Project. Again, it is titled The Life and Death of August Sweeney. And Sam Ashworth, we welcome you to the morning show.
I thank you so much for having me. I'll tell you, there is a greater pleasure than losing yourself in a book, and it's writing a book and then hearing an introduction like that. That was a delight. Thank you.
Well, it is no secret.
I'm Gregory Berg, and I hope that you can join me for Monday's morning show here on WGTD. One of our scheduled guests for Monday's program is Tyler August, who is the state representative for the 31st Assembly District, who also serves as the Assembly Majority Leader. We will be talking with him about his concerns regarding Governor...
typically read it, and I don't always enjoy it. I loved your book, and I'm anxious to explore it with you over the next few minutes. I do first, though, want to give you a chance to talk a bit about your own background as a writer, and particularly as a professor of creative writing. And I wonder, first of all, kind of about the balance in your own life between teaching others to write and finding time for your own writing. Tell us about that dance, if we want to call it that.
I mean, a dance is one way. It's kind of a spastic and chaotic one. You asked about balance, and I think maybe the answer to that question is there is no balance. It is unbalanced. Everything is rocking and sloshing around in the bathtub of my life. I have two small children. I live in Washington, D.C. now, and I teach because I love it. It's something that I feel I need to do. And for a lot of writers, teaching is sort of the pathway. The idea that there are the number of authors, especially literary fiction authors, who can make a living of any kind off their books is so tiny as to be infinitesimal. Even high-profile marquee authors, they teach or they have other sources of income. For me, teaching isn't a source of income so much as it is something that I do to keep myself from unschooling. Because when you're a writer, when you're doing your job, you're kind of alone. You're spending time immured in your room with the people that you're making up in your mind, and that's very close to the definition of clinical insanity. So I need to be in a room with students. I need to be talking to people. And when it comes to teaching writing, it's one of those things that any writing teacher will tell you is difficult to teach, right? You cannot transform the way a person writes, and nor should you. So for me, I actually do two things as a writing teacher. I teach craft, I teach literature, I help with workshops and so forth. But I also do something that I really care about, which is I teach students about the industry. I created the class a couple years ago called The Working Writer. And between you and me and the audience, the original pitch was called Writing for Money.
Huh.
And then the department said, well, how much money are we talking about? And I told them, and they were like, let's change the title. But what I wanted to do was to create a course through which aspiring writers could be given enough of a roadmap to the industry we want to enter that when they are ready to approach it, they can actually navigate. Because what very frequently happens is we now have the creative writing teaching industry in America is now immense. MFA programs are very popular, not just for students, but also for universities, because for many universities, MFA programs are a source of very low-cost teaching help. If you're in a funded MFA program, you are teaching. You're working in the writing center. You're teaching composition. You're doing stuff like that. And so there are a lot of people coming out with these degrees, very few of whom are actually being taught what it takes to make a career in this. And what happens is a lot of them wind up going into teaching or falling out of the industry for want of exposure to what it looks like to do this as a career. So what I try to do is I give my students, they hear from agents and editors and magazine editors, but they also hear from speechwriters. They'll hear from TV writers. They'll hear from copywriters. They hear from people who work in book production. So they start to get a broader vision of all of the different ways it's possible to do this for a living. And then we talk about money. We talk about advocating for yourself. We talk about contract. We even talk about taxes. And I realize that this is unromantic coming from a writing teacher. But to my mind, these are the things that aspiring writers need to know at any age if they want to make this career sustainable.
This is your first novel, or at least it's your first officially published novel. I can't fathom that you've never written a novel before this one. I'm assuming that you have other novels that were maybe attempted novels or novels never finished or finished but not published or finished but not even shared with the world. Can you share your own relationship with the novel and to what extent this work is indeed your first novel or just what?
I think you scratch the surface of any writer and you're going to find they have a novel in a drawer. We all sort of do. I have one in a drawer. I did when I was about 25 or 6. I sat down and started writing my first book, and it got pretty far. I finished it. I found an agent. We took it on submission. We revised it. We went on for a couple years with it, giving it a shot, and it never sold, never caught on. And finally, we put it to sleep humanely. And thank God, because it was terrible. It's not good. I'm glad it does not exist in the world. I learned a huge amount about pacing, structure, and how I write. Writing a book is a muscle, and it's one that you can only develop by doing the thing. And so what I learned about creating a piece of entertainment that meant something to me, that could still deliver a strong emotional payoff, really came from that first failed book, which I will never allow to see the light of day. It was empty. It wasn't really about anything. And so when I started writing this one, actually before that one even had representation, and then I put it aside for years and years. And when I came back to this one, I had one thing that really helped, which was that I knew what it was like to dislike the thing I was writing. And I cannot overstate how valuable that knowledge is, because writing is frustrating for everybody. We all get mad at ourselves. We're anxious. But there is a difference between that and outright disliking the thing that you've written. And that's how I felt about that first book. And when I would work on August, no matter how frustrating or difficult it was, I never felt anything beside this is the book that I want. And when we were submitting it, even when it took a while, I was able to go back to it and look at it and say, should I have done it differently? Should I have made this easier? And it just kept coming back to, this was the book I wanted to write. And that's what I love about it, that it feels like I did the thing I set out to do. But no, I do think that that first book taught me a huge amount.
We're speaking with Sam Ashworth, and we are about to talk now about his first published novel, which is called The Life and Death of August Sweeney. As I was attempting to describe the novel and these sort of two competing storylines and these two main characters, I was trying to imagine what the sales pitch would sound like. You to go to a publisher and say, I have this great idea for a novel. It's about this this doctor who does autopsies and this famous chef, and she's doing an autopsy on him and trying to learn about his life along the way. And as I listen to those words, I just feel like they don't begin to do justice to how wonderfully crafted this novel is and how much it makes sense, because in some ways it sort of feels like it shouldn't make sense. It just seems like in the hands of a less than masterful writer, it sort of seems like a formula for chaos and confusion, which it just isn't there. But maybe you could talk for a moment about the process of actually crafting this novel, and was it kind of a wrestling match to bring this intriguing idea into some sort of cohesive form that could connect with readers?
It's a great question, and I'll tell you, it was a challenge to sell it for exactly the reasons that you're describing. If you tell a publisher, I'm going to tell you, write you a novel about the rise and fall of a celebrity chef, they say, oh, yes, please, and then you follow it up by saying, and I'm going to tell it through his autopsy. They go, sorry, what? We don't have great metrics for autopsy books. Is that necessary? So it was a challenge. I had a very powerful agent, and it was a lot of people just said, we don't know how to market this, and I don't blame them. I've been having trouble marketing it, and I'm deeply grateful to people like you for seeing it for what it is. But part of the reason why it emerged like this was because to me it always made sense. I started this book It came because out of my mouth one day, I was talking to somebody in a bar in Boston where I was working, and I said, wouldn't it be interesting to tell a person's life story through the dissection of their body? And, you know, the kind of thing that just falls out of your mouth. And I just stared off into the middle distance for a good minute or two. Like, they were waving their hand in front of my face because I realized that had never been done before. And it's hard in literature to find a subject that has not been done before. But when you think about it, fiction can – it takes us everywhere, right? Anywhere you would like to go in the cosmos, in time, there is fiction out there that'll take you there. The one exception to that, as far as I could see, was inside our own body. There is very, very, very little fiction that dives deep into the functioning of our bodies. The Ian McEwan's Saturday, which came out in 2005, does this for the brain, and McEwan spent 2 years shadowing surgeons in London, learning neurosurgery. And then there's a book called Being Dead by Jim Crace, which is sort of from the perspective of two bodies decomposing on a beach, which is much more about decay and death and the physical processes of it. But I wanted a book that would transform a reader's relationship with their own body, and it's transformed my relationship with mine. And the question usually is, well, where does the food element come in? Like, how do you get the food from there? And that's a really simple story. I started out by going down to a friend's Gross Anatomy lab in Philadelphia. And I originally imagined the book to cover the a Gross Anatomy semester from the perspective of a medical student. Maya Drew was going to be a medical student. So I went down there, and I had never seen a dead body in my life. And she took me into her anatomy lab, and there were 40 cadavers preserved and in various stages of dissection, because that is how you start life as a medical student, by doing gross anatomy. And my reaction was that I got really, really, really hungry. And I found out that that is, in fact, a very common reaction for medical students, even for professors who have done this a long time. Being in an anatomy lab makes people hungry. And there, you know, you can speculate about reasons for why, but part of it has to do with the fact that your body reacts to the presence of death by wanting to feed, by your appetite erupting. And once I had that piece of information, it made sense for the body on the table. The question was always, who was the person on the table going to be? And it made sense for him to be a cook, someone who had dealt with food, because a lot of the skills that you use as an autopsist or a chef, it's a lot of knife work, bluntly put. And when that came together, the book became all about human appetite, because that's what it is to be alive. To be alive is to hunger, whether for nourishment or success or other people. And it became an exploration of hunger and appetite. So the two things were always joined together, and after that I was never able to pull them apart. And that's why I'm so glad when I get responses to the book that say, at the beginning, I could not see how these two things went together, and now I cannot think of them apart.
Right, exactly. It seems like a perfect melding, but so unlikely at the outset. But it does indeed work.
Pitch.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Well, thank goodness somebody had the vision to understand and appreciate the possibilities here. And one thing, I if we were talking all day, we would talk at great length about all that you did to try to learn as much as you did about
what goes on in an autopsy lab or what goes on in the kitchen of a fine restaurant. And suffice to say that you took plenty of time to experience that and then draw upon that expertise in crafting this book. But I think we need to spend a little time talking about these two main characters and how you crafted them. And let's begin with the chef, August Sweeney, a man who is so remarkable and someone who, on the one hand, we feel like we've met people or seen people like this, and yet he seems utterly one of a kind. And someone whose life was colorful and full of ups and full of downs. Tell us your process of shaping this character of August Sweeney, and what you sort of considered in terms of ultimately making him as compelling as he turns out to be.
August began as a body. There was a question that I had, which was, like I said, who is the person on the table? And what I knew was that I needed him to be the most fascinating human body I could imagine, because I needed to get the attention of Maya Ju. I needed her to see how special he was, because there is a way that you don't, as an autopsist or as a medical student, you don't want to think about the person that you are doing, that you are dissecting. So I needed his body to be just compelling, and I needed it to exert its own gravity almost. And so he began as an immense figure. He always was. He's like Pantagruel. He's like Falstaff. That's why he has a Hal in the book, his sort of disciple who winds up kind of betraying him. I named him Hal on purpose because he's always been Falstaff in my head. So that's how August begins, as just the most gargantuan, fascinating body I could think of. And from there, I started thinking about he came out of his career, right? How did he become? I always knew I wanted him to get famous. I wanted him to grow huge. And then it all became about, how do you get there? How does he work within the restaurant industry in New York, starting in the 80s? And that's really how he evolved.
One of the interesting things about him is the unlikely combinations. That, for instance, August is physically huge. And so from seventh grade, he is a force to be reckoned with on the football field. Do you mind if I read just one passage when you're talking about his exploits on the football field?
I would love it.
Yeah. So on the first day of school in seventh grade, the St. Bernard football coach all but threw himself at August's feet. At 12, he was already 6'1", 190, and only getting started. August played fullback and linebacker, and as much as he loved scoring touchdowns, he lived for the hitting. The larger he grew, the more fragile the world around him became. Things that came into his orbit just seemed to break more often. He had to be careful when hugging his mother now, or when loading the dishwasher at home. But on the football field, he didn't have to worry. He found an odd peace, an unambiguous purpose, in lowering his helmet like a battering ram and hurling his full mass into someone with no motive beyond bringing that person down. It was as if August had been purpose-built for football. And, of course,
can you do the audiobook?
Right. That would be fun. So, but it's so interesting to think about this world-famous chef who was also this football player, and the way in which there is a certain appetite, a certain drive that is sort of one and the same, but playing out in different ways. I'm curious how you came up with this aspect of August Sweeney.
Well, I think one thing that's fascinating about chefs especially. And I came out of this having spent a long time. I've been working in the service industry since I was 16. My dad was a restaurant architect in New York. So the restaurants have always been a part of my life, and they're the only business I understand, really. They're the only – they're an organism that I've always been fascinated by, and one that I think that the literary world has never really done full justice to. There aren't a lot of great pieces of literature out there about restaurants and chefs. But one of the fascinating things about cooks is that not many of them start out life or even start their adolescence knowing that this is what they want to do. It's a world that draws people in for reasons that don't often have to do with food. And that's sort of what happens to August. August isn't always, because of his size, because of how fragile the world can seem around him, he needs an environment where people are not fragile, where people are, where it's intense and physical and sweaty, and he falls into it as a dishwasher when he's 15 years old, and he's just, that's where he finds a home. And this happens, I think, to a lot of cooks. They get into a restaurant, they get into a kitchen, and they're like, this is where I know who I am.
Mm.
Right? This is an order that I've craved. And there is a lot of love for order in kitchens. There's very chaotic people often, but inside, that is the ordered, non-chaotic space where you know who you are, where you know what you have to do. And so that August kind of keeps falling, like, backwards into success. He keeps, I wouldn't say he fails upward, but August leads a charmed life. That's part of his appeal. He makes other people around him feel that same charm.
Right. And one of the choices you make is that in the way you're novel alternates between his life and then his autopsy, we are seeing, in a sense, snapshots of his life as he moves on from stage to stage to stage, and we're left to, I suppose, kind of imagine, how did he get from here to here? How did he climb the ladder from there to there? And you know, one novel could have been nothing but his rise and fall, but I love the fact that we are only, in a sense, seeing the stages and left with kind of this mystery of how it all unfolded, although it all feels like it makes perfect sense. One of my favorite passages is at a point when he is now in a fairly responsible position in a restaurant and making some terrible mistakes when it comes to buying very, very expensive cuts of meat and so on, that are going to ultimately go to waste because he's ends up purchasing far more than the restaurant can ever use or can ever sell. And I mean, it's terrible waste and a painful monetary loss for this owner named Timo. And you have the character of August at one point saying he couldn't help it. Every time he looked at the purveyor list, something came over him. It was as if a valve was opened in his chest and his imagination burst forth. So here is this aspiring chef not really yet knowing exactly what to do or how to do it, but you're speaking to this hunger that he had to achieve fame as a chef, even if he was going to make some painful mistakes along the way.
Yeah, and I think that scene especially, it resonates for me so much as an artist because August is discovering art, right? He's discovering how much more food can be than he'd ever imagined. He has control of this restaurant, and you know, and this place is like a family restaurant in Queens. And he's buying foie gras and king crab because it's on the purveyor list and he can't. And he asks, like, isn't that my job to make great food? And as an artist, there comes a moment where you reckon with the fact that, like, art is also an industry, where there are economic realities of art, where you have to get people to read your book, where you have to get people to buy your painting, where you have to get somebody to actually produce your play. And that's a difficult moment for all of us, right? It's not just about the quality. It's not just about the greatness. It's about cost. And these things matter because it's not just about you. I think that's a very hard lesson for a lot of artists to learn. And when you're a chef, the end of that scene is, you know, Timo shows him all of the people that are working in the restaurant. He tells them quickly their stories. You know, this one came from a boat in Haiti. This one is putting her little sister through school. And August says, yeah, so they work for me. And Timo says, no, you work for them. And that's a transformative moment for August. And it was an important moment for me to write too, because, you know, buried in that scene is, to an extent, I think, me making my own peace with what it means to be a working artist.
Well, and I think you really help us understand the artistry behind great food when a little bit later in the novel, August Sweeney is in a very different sort of restaurant, a much more elegant restaurant where a celebration is taking place with August and Timo. And he is... First of all, it's an incredibly quiet restaurant, although they both know behind the scenes there is all kinds of things going on back in the kitchen. And here's part of this wonderful passage. As the dishes arrived at the table, August tried to fix each one in his memory. He wished he'd brought a camera. Over and over, he asked Timo what these things were called, but the French names all slid off his memory like butter off of a hot knife. But the music of it, the song each bite sang along his lips and tongue, he knew these would remain with him all his life. And eventually you have the character of August Sweeney going to France and studying a whole different kind of culinary enterprise and being humbled and yet glorified as he... tries to thrive in this new environment before being summoned back home, and ultimately, of course, his career climaxes in, at least in terms of fame, when he ends up having actually one or more of his own television programs on the Food Network, and from there is a fall, but we won't explore all of that. But I love the way you have chronicled this man's journey. And I guess what I appreciate especially is that so often when we think about people like this, or even maybe when somebody writes about somebody like this, so often it feels simplified and kind of dumbed down. And I feel like you have wanted to embrace the complexity of this man's life and journey.
I feel like if you're not trying to do that, what are you doing? If you're not trying to evoke and explore the complexity of your world, why bother? I especially if you love the thing that you're writing about, and I love restaurants. I just, as an organism, I love them, and I wanted to give them in all of their complexity and difficulty and joy, really. And I wanted to do the same thing for the body, this impossibly complicated machine. And every one of us gets one. And we only get one. And to know and understand the meaning of that, like the preciousness of this gift, I do want people to understand the complexity of their body, of the functioning that keeps them alive minute to minute, second to second.
And towards that end, of course, that is the other principal character in your novel, every bit as fascinating, Dr. Maya Zhu, who has been summoned to do the autopsy of this man, whom at first she does not even know. He just has a number. I think he's number 289, the 289th autopsy done in that lab that year. And she is meticulous in the work that she does, and meticulous and relentless in the way she works with the students who are shadowing her in this particular case as they watch what she does. Going into this, did you have any notion of how fascinating this kind of work is? Or at what point did you realize this could be such fertile ground for you?
The Maya parts, Maya half, it's one day in her life, right? It's 52 years in August's life. It's one day in Maya's life. And Maya started life as a medical student. And finally, I had to accept the fact that a medical student, no matter how gifted, simply wouldn't have the knowledge that I needed Maya to have. I wanted Maya to be as gifted at what she does as August is, except in a very different way. She's kind of a savant. She can read bodies the way that, you know, you and I can read a text. And so I knew I needed her to be a full-fledged pathologist. The problem was that I had not, I had been in an anatomy lab, but I'd never seen an autopsy. And this is where I caught a big, big, big break. A guy I knew from high school was doing his residency in pathology. And pathologists are the ones who are the doctors who perform autopsies. And in order to become one, even if you're not an autopsy pathologist, as most of them aren't, you have to do 50 in order to be accredited. So he was a resident at a university hospital in Pittsburgh, and he happened to be working for maybe the only pathologist in America who was happy to let some random grad student and journalist into his lab for 2 weeks.
Wow.
And what was funny was I had actually written a lot of Maya scenes before I went. And mostly I was basing them off, like, what I had seen on television, right? We've all seen dozens and dozens of autopsies. There are no less than 13, I think, primetime dramas that heavily feature autopsies, like, running right now, right? There's all the CSIs. There's all the NCISs. Law and Order does this left and right. And then there, you know, there were shows like Bones and House and the Good Doctor. And so I just, as a lot of writers do, like, I based it on what I had seen on TV. And the minute I walked into that lab, I knew that every single thing I'd written was worthless. I threw out every word of it. And immediately, because I had no concept. For one thing, and I have a piece coming out about this in The Atlantic, right, I think around March 20, everything that television has taught you about autopsies is wrong. And I have a whole soapbox thing about this and the damage that TV shows have done to our understanding of the autopsy and how that actually becomes a very big problem when families are in a hospital with a deceased loved one and they get asked whether or not they want an autopsy. Because you know who else has only seen an autopsy on television? Is the doctor. So that's a whole separate subject. But as soon as I walked in, I realized that, A, everything I'd written had to be thrown out. But B, I was onto something that nobody had really done in literature. There's a number of pathologists who have written, like, mystery novels. Right, that's where the Bone series comes from. There are a few others, but these are all about foul play and forensics, and this is not that. There's no mystery why August died. But what I knew was that I was seeing something extraordinary and beautiful, and that the person who chose this life had to be very strong and very humane, but humane in a way you keep very controlled. Like, you have to be able to almost turn off your empathy, but not obliterate it to do the job.
Hmm. I remember this character at one point talking about empathy and essentially saying that empathy is a terrible drug sometimes. And she goes on to think to herself, there are plenty of empathetic people out there, social workers, television psychics, doctors without borders. And she thinks to herself, I am a doctor with firm borders. The world needs people like me, the way airplanes need gravity to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows her to do this work as well as she does, that sense of being able to create distance.
But for her, that not, I don't want to say lack of empathy, but her shutting off her empathy, because she wishes she was a sociopath, but unfortunately she isn't one. But so she works very hard to cut herself off from things. She has the same hungers that August does, but she fanatically controls them. And her story in the book is learning how to be more herself, more open, to allow more empathy into her life without fearing that it's going to destroy her, right? To be more of a daughter, to be a friend to people, and even to be a teacher. Right, she has to come to those things over the course of this one day. And the basic way I constructed her story was that I have a very simple rubric for what gets me interested in stories. I'm fascinated by people who do extraordinary things. That could be working in an ER. That could be running a government agency. That could even be hosting a radio show. You take those things, and then you imagine how they become routine to the person doing it, right? For you, you've done a lot. I've never hosted a radio show. You've hosted a lot, right? So there's a certain routine that's soaked into your bones about this. And then we meet that person on the day that it isn't routine anymore, right? So you take all the expertise and knowledge that they have, and you challenge them. You challenge everything about that routine. You force them out of it. And that's what happens to Maya. She's done 289 bodies this year alone. But this day is very, very different.
Right. It certainly is. And along the way, we learn so much about what it means to do a meticulous autopsy. And one of the earliest scenes is when she is having an exchange with one of these students who is observing her in action, and she poses a question, the student begins to ask, and then she stops them and says, I didn't ask what you think, I ask what you see. And that, as far as she's concerned, this is about the most amazing, penetrating observation. And it is not about jumping to conclusions or connecting dots, but it is about observing, and observing even the smallest of details and understanding what those details represent. And it's just fascinating and exhilarating to think about somebody doing this kind of work in that kind of way.
Yeah, that's what I loved about her, right? She is this human scalpel. She sees so clearly. But that's I dream of this being taught in medical schools, and I've actually spoken, a number of doctors have read it, and they say this, in fact, should be taught in medical schools, because it's a more complete picture of an autopsy than most students will ever get, and most doctors will ever get. And that became something that I cared very deeply about the more I got into it. I spent 2 weeks in that lab in Pittsburgh and assisting with the autopsies. I was allowed to sort of do everything except handle sharp objects, which was more for my protection than anyone else's. And I came away from it evangelical about the value and importance of autopsies, which are really have become an endangered species, not just in America, but around the world.
Hmm. I especially appreciate the whole matter of the truth that can be learned about somebody in an autopsy. At one point, you have Dr. Zhu saying, the living lie, the dead can't. But then she goes on to say, but that doesn't mean they give up the truth easily. But I mean, it is so interesting to think about a body that lies there and it is past the time for excuses or explanations or outright lies. It is just, in a sense, the cold, hard facts lying on that table. And the person doing the autopsy is seeking the unvarnished truth about this person. And I remember at some point in the novel, the question is either why they died or how they died. And it's so interesting to think about those two questions and how she believes one of those questions is preferable to the other.
Yeah, and that's part of what, that's really one of the things that I learned in doing deep research. After I went to the lab, I wound up writing a very large piece about the decline of the autopsy, and it wound up having to do a lot with COVID. And that question of why a person died versus how, it seems academic, but it isn't, because the how, like, here's an example. I'll ask you a question. What percentage of death certificates in the U.S. do you think have an error in the cause of death section? Just like throw out a number.
Right. Well, I know the correct answer, but I would think very few.
You read the book.
I did. But if I hadn't read the book, I would guess quite a small number. You know, 5 to 10% or something, at the
most. Right. And the real number is,
I think, 50.
50. And that's because the person filling out the death certificate is usually rushed, doesn't actually know how to diagnose death. And so you get a lot of people write cardiac arrest. We all die of cardiac arrest. Like, eventually, the heart stops. But for families and for hospitals and for the doctors who are doing this, understanding why people die is vitally important. It can be very important for families, not just for emotional clarity, but also perhaps for, like, physical reasons, for questions of heredity and genetics, right? If somebody has dementia, is it Alzheimer's? Is it Lewy body syndrome? Is it something else? These things really matter to families, and it's their answers we don't often get. So, I mean, this is how I wound up becoming evangelical and soapboxy about this. But I go back to what you said at the beginning, where you talked about how usually you prefer nonfiction books. You like that they're true, that the stories are true. And the way I see this story is that I think it is a true story. I just happened to make it up.
Very well put, and so based on scientific truth and reality. And we learn so much, not only about these two characters and their lives and how they're put together, but also about the worlds which each of them inhabit. One, the world of culinary exploits, the other, the world of the autopsy lab. It all comes to life and flows together in amazing fashion in this novel called The Life and Death of August Sweeney, published by the Santa Fe Writers Project, and the author, Sam Ashworth. Sam Ashworth, congratulations on a wonderful novel. I so enjoyed it and this opportunity to talk with you about it. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is after all this time of writing it and getting ready for it to come out to get to have a conversation like this. It means everything.
And Monday on The Morning Show, we are scheduled to speak with Tyler August, Majority Leader for the Wisconsin State Assembly. Today's going to be partly sunny and mild, a 40% chance of some afternoon rain developing, and a high of 49 degrees. Cold and rainy overnight with a low of 39. Cloudy tomorrow with a high of 51. Sunshine should return on Sunday, high right around 50. Snow showers possible on Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.